Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. The Democratic Convention is over, and amazingly, the Democrats didn't, they managed not to screw this thing up. In fact, they ended in kind of an impressive note. So to wrap up the whole week, Tim Miller joins me once again from the West Coast. How are you doing, Tim?
Charlie, I'm jazzed. I'm excited to be with you. Tim Miller all the time now. You got newsletters, you got people got podcasts, people got my takes, I got my tweets. You know, people are going to be really sick of me soon, but hopefully not quite yet.
We have 73 days to go. Can't get enough Tim Miller. Okay, I have to start off on this because can you just give me a minute here?
Please, so, take the preach.
So on yesterday's podcast, I managed to mispronounce Kamala Harris's name.
Okay.
And I got huge blowback, show some respect, how unprofessional. And I wrote back saying, you know what? It wasn't because I was being disrespectful. It's because I'm an idiot. I mean, I know how to pronounce Kamala Harris's name. I've said it 100 times, but I think I have this weird thing, it's just me. So I apologize. It was not intentional. And I really appreciate it. I think it's actually a good sign that so many people would write to rip me for getting it wrong because it shows that they were paying attention to it. It was like a test. Are you actually listening here? But there's something about it. My wife is exactly the opposite. She can hear any foreign language, any accent, and she will pick it up instantly. And I am the opposite. Let's just say I have not been blessed with this. So this is one of the reasons when I have people on the podcast or my radio show, I would actually go through, tell me your name. How do you pronounce it? I really don't want to pronounce it wrong. About 50% of the time, I would pronounce it wrong. So anyway, I apologize.
Well, while we're doing mea culpas, can I just chime in? Because I think it'll be a good transition.
Self-flagellation.
Self-flagellation. Here was the first sentence of my guest newsletter for JVL yesterday. The Zoom convention deal has been a bit of a slog, and if I'm being honest, it's kind of hard to believe it isn't over yet. Are we sure we really needed 4 days of this?
Yeah.
So, I mean, maybe it was right in the broadest sense that we didn't need 4 days of this, but the fourth day was quite a lot better than the other three, and made my take look a little poor, and made the repliers who were enjoying it, I think, get the win on that one.
Well, let me confess, I was feeling the same way about all of this, and I was actually listening to a cable channel that will remain nameless, and I'm thinking, there's a lot of fan service going on here. There's a lot of gushing. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of this is perhaps not helpful, and so I was pretty geared up. I put my cynical hat on. So I was going to be the rough-hewn H.L. Mencken-ish guy who has the sort of, the jaundiced view of the convention. And about halfway through that last hour, I'm going, hey, somebody slap me, because, I mean, this is actually not awful. This is not the worst thing I've ever seen, okay? So, I mean, it was pretty, I wrote in my newsletter, I said, look, this wasn't what we were promised. I mean, we'd been told this was going to be the Antifa convention, right? That it was, senile Joe was going to get up there and he was going to drool. He wouldn't be able to string together a coherent sentence. And we would just be inundated with all of these virulent Marxists who would hate God and America, and they wanted to destroy all things good and beautiful.
That's obviously massive hyperbole that I've mocked at length. But even in contrast to the debates, we did kind of get that at the debates, right? I mean, no, we didn't get the Antifa debates of hating God and stuff. But the first few Democratic debates in particular, we're leaning off the left edge of the party for sure.
Yeah, right. That's true. But this convention, this was, I don't know, when you and I did a video yesterday, I gotta say, I mean, it's almost spooky how it seemed to be programmed for people like us. It was, I mean, I was talking to somebody who's actually much more conservative than I am, who watched Biden's speech and said, he didn't actually say anything at all that I found to be disqualifying. In fact, a lot of the stuff that took place last night, it could have been at a Republican convention. Did you catch John Meacham? I mean, John Meacham's speech could have been at any Republican convention over the last 20 years, and everybody would have thought, this is great. This is absolutely fantastic.
And I did a panel with him after Trump won. It was a weird kind of panel. It was me and Karl Rove and John Meacham. I'm not really sure why I was invited to the panel, but it was in front of kind of this blue-haired Republican audience, and they loved it. It was all the same shtick that he gave last night, and everybody's clapping and cheering, and they were booing me, you know, every time I would call out Carl for going on board with too far with Trumpism. I was getting booed, and John Meacham was getting the star treatment. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that it was not even just an appeal to us. I think it was an appeal to people even more Trump curious than us, frankly, which is good, which is what you need to win over. You know, and I think that probably they're having the opposite takeout on the Chapo Trap House podcast this morning, because there was not a lot of outreach to that wing.
That's true. In fact, I was wondering. I mean, you know, here's, you know, Joe Biden coming out with the American flag pin. Look, I'm not trying to say that the Chapo people are going to be upset with the flag. Well, who knows? But there was a lot of appeals. Did you see? This is weird. Franklin Graham. I just tweeted out something on this. Franklin Graham, one of the leading evangelical supporters of Trump, tweeted out, this about, you know, 11 hours ago from when we're taping this here, in watching some of the Democratic convention on television, it has been interesting to see the absence of God. I don't believe America's finest hours will be in front of us if we take God out of government and public life. It is God who set the standards we are to live by. And someone else tweeted back at him saying, look, Biden didn't say God is testing me when he tragically lost his wife, daughter, and later on his son, Beau. Instead, Biden relied on his love for his children and found purpose in serving others. If you can't see God in his life story, your God must be different than mine. And I read Franklin Graham's tweet and I said, well, what the hell are you watching here? Because it was really striking to me that in terms of just traditional values of patriotism and family and culture and character, that there was a lot more in this convention than you're going to see next week in the Trump convention.
Yeah, this was going on. One of the staffers was sending, you know, on our Slack channel a screenshot of a text from a Trumpy family member who was making the same complaint. So this must be going around. But I really don't understand what they're watching. It's like Earth. It's completely Earth 2. I mean, Joe Biden does talk about God also, like, quite a bit, I think.
Quite a bit.
Yeah. I mean, and so I mean, it's just, I think that it shows the level of the critics on the right and how much they had to grasp. And if you look at the Fox programming last night after the speech.
Let's do that. Should we do that?
Oh, do you have this queued up already, Charlie? We're so simpatico right now.
Do. Okay, so here's Chris Wallace on Fox News.
Oh, I thought it was an enormously effective speech. Remember, Donald Trump has been talking for months about Joe Biden as mentally shot, a captive of the left. And yes, Biden was reading from a teleprompter and a prepared speech, but I thought that he blew a hole, a big hole in that characterization. You talked about the line that character is on the ballot, decency is on the ballot. He talked about a different path for the country, not in a deep programmatic sense, but he did talk about plans for the virus and the economy, for climate change and race and foreign policy. And he talked about what a united America can do to accomplish all of those things. It seems to me that after tonight, Donald Trump is going to have to run against a candidate, not a caricature. The Democrats have had a good convention. Now it's the Republicans' turn.
Well, of course, you know, don't underestimate how compelling that that couple from St. Louis with the guns will be. I mean, we haven't heard from them yet. So that was Chris Wallace.
It wasn't Dana just Corey. The Rhino Cut, yeah. Chris Wallace, Dana Perino, yeah. Even Laura. You know, even Laura.
Okay, so let's do Dana Perino, who I'm guessing got a lot of flack the other night when she praised Michelle Obama's speech. But this is what she said after the Biden speech last night.
Look, the other night I said that Michelle Obama stuck the landing. I think, keeping with that theme, that Joe Biden just hit a home run in the bottom of the ninth, which I think I got that right in terms of the sports. He had pace, rhythm, energy, emotion, and delivery. So I think that if he looks back, he's got to say that's probably the best speech of his life. And he really just took the moment. And I love there was.
Yeah, hitting it in the bottom of the ninth. Tim Alberta, you know, grizzled old cynical reporter, he tweeted out, he said, for once I'm struggling to locate the appropriate sports metaphor. He was looking for that too. But we're watching an old ball player whose skills have diminished turn in a career best performance in the biggest game of his life. Remarkable to witness. So, you know, I'm pushing back against this irrational exuberance, but that was a pretty good. That was a damn good speech, wasn't it?
I mean, Charlie, I'm gonna preach. Get behind the pulpit here for a second, for a minute or two, because I think I was on this podcast after the very first or second debate, and Joe Biden had that red sty in his eye.
Ooh, yeah.
You know, you remember this? And
yeah,
like we were talking about it. He looked bad. He was shaky on the facts. Mm-hmm. Throughout the campaign, he had moments. There's this old, I think it was Jay Nordlinger wrote about kind of how Reagan staffed, you know, it would sometimes worry when he was asked a question and he'd start going down a path that he wouldn't be able to kind of land the plane on where he was supposed to land it. You worry about that sometimes with Biden, like he gets asked a question, you're holding on. You're like, is he coming around to the right answer here? I'm not saying that he, you know, all this ridiculousness that he has dementia or that he's sundowning. But my expectations even were just like, you know, let's do this guy. You know, like you're almost rooting for him to get across the line a little bit because let's just be honest, like his performance has been hot and cold over the course of the campaign. And so I'm sitting there waiting for him, you know, with a little bit of anxiety.
Yep.
And not only did he like deliver, he gave the best damn speech of the convention.
I know.
Like, he gave a better speech than Barack and Michelle Obama.
Really? You think so?
I think so. I mean, I thought that in, especially given the format, I think that Michelle did him and Michelle, we can call it a tie. I think that Michelle did a very, you know, is obviously very familiar with kind of speaking to Zoom. So her speech was a little different. She's sitting and she's almost like FaceTiming her kids. You know, Biden gave it more as a traditional speech. Obama looked awkward, I thought, for the first like 10 minutes of his speech. You know, I mean, he got into it when he got into the John Lewis part and he got rolling. But Biden, you know, this is a high degree of difficulty to give this big, massive speech to an empty room, to look in command, to not lose energy. You know, I mean, This is not an easy speech to give. You know, it's not landed on the beaches of Normandy, but it's not nothing. He crushed it. And the messaging was good. There was a story that they were telling. You know, I felt like Kamala's speech a little bit was sort of a grab bag. Biden had a message that he was trying to get across. He delivered it powerfully. There were emotional moments. There were very serious moments addressing the seriousness of what we face, addressing the president's failures, the Charlottesville moment. You saw his anger. I was moved. He knocked out of the park. And I don't, and people, you know, some people are like, it's his best speech ever. If you think it's his best speech ever, you have to go watch his speech to the family members of soldiers who've died in action, which is actually his best speech ever. But as far as a political speech is concerned, I do think it was his best performance that I can recall from a political speech.
You just made an interesting point there, because a lot of people, you know, who were, in fact, I was talking about this with somebody before the speech, who was very, very nervous about it and was, you know, figuring this might be a big letdown. And I noted I said, make sure you read that New York Times story about him as a speaker, that he's got a lot of experience delivering these powerful emotional speeches, that when people want someone to deliver a eulogy, he's the go-to guy because of that thing he's got, that empathy thing he's got. I think we had underestimated him. You know, I think we've talked about this probably a dozen times on the podcast, the amazing decision, if you can call it that, by the Republicans to lower the bar, to simply say, to invest so much energy into senile Joe, sleepy Joe who can't, you know, coherently put together a paragraph. They really set themselves up for what happened last night. Because we, you know, the cliche was all he needed to do was show up and talk, and he wins. But he did a lot more than that. It was it was a powerful speech. And Kayla, I'm going to get a little bit wonky because you're the pro on this.
Yeah,
I'm still trying to process through the difference between the traditional convention where you're, you know, with these stentorian, you know, tones and the, you know, massive applause lines and the speeches that are twice as long. By the way, this was the shortest, you know, speech in modern history in terms of acceptance speeches because it wasn't interrupted. But that's a completely different genre. And of course, there's a lot of excitement behind it. And you could do, I'm sure you can imagine the way the crowd might have responded to some of his lines. But on the other hand, this whole Zoom convention, it's so much more intimate, and it allows the speakers to express emotion and to show themselves in a way that the traditional convention never could. You know what I'm saying? There were moments when Michelle Obama is looking into the camera and you could just tell that she was connecting in a way that you couldn't connect to a convention hall with, you know, 30,000 people. Same thing with Obama. And I thought that was a really good thing for Joe Biden.
Because you really felt it, just real quick on Obama before you get to Joe Biden. For me, I really felt it when he was talking about the civil rights part.
Yeah,
and the word that just kept coming to me is he was seething. You could just feel his anger talking about what had happened to these men and women, and how they'd been treated, and how this current president is crapping on their legacy, and how he's like basically carrying the torch for their tormentors. I mean, you could see him get madder and madder and madder as he was sort of talking about that section. And that is, you know, what you're talking about. Like, you can't, that is not replicable, really, in front of, you know, a stage with balloons and, like, you know, donkey hats and all that sort of stuff.
No, you're right about that. Okay, now, there are some criticisms that are out there of the convention saying that it didn't focus as much as it ought to have on your blue-collar workers economically, you know, suffering economic pain. In places like Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Ohio, you had a lot of, you know, I read one critique, you know, pointing out that, you know, they had done a lot of programming to the Democratic woke elites, and maybe to, you know, folks like us, but once again, did not really focus. You didn't have the union guys. You didn't have enough focus on the economic problems and economic solutions. You didn't get the kind of thing that you would have gotten from a Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren about how to address those economic inequalities. Your take?
I agree with that. I mean, I think that's a fair criticism. I think that. I forget who it was that said this. I'm stealing this take, but they, you know, they tweeted something like, "Oh, so I see we're doing the Hillary convention all over again."
Yes, I saw that.
Yeah, right. And I think that was a fair criticism, with a couple caveats. Number one, Joe Biden isn't Hillary Clinton, and so, you know, I think that while Hillary Clinton kind of had a lot more work to do with the blue collar working class crowd than Joe Biden does, and she didn't really even try. I think Joe Biden kind of exudes some of this, and there was some of it at the convention. Like, there were, you know, the some of the real people videos, you know, were working class type folk. It wasn't as if they totally ignored it. I think that's one, you know, I think that the focus on kind of the celebrity, you know, for shorthand, woke kind of lefty, you know, identity politics stuff was like a little overdone. It's just that people who care about that are already in the tent here, you know.
Yeah.
So I don't know that making an appeal to them is that useful. You know, some of it's necessary. I think, like, having Billie Eilish on, you know, that stuff that's going to go around on Instagram and have the kind of Zoomers see it, that's good. You know, Kamala, it's hard to not talk about the identity stuff when you have the first Black woman ever getting the VP.
Billie Eilish, did you happen to see that Orrin Hatch tweeted out a picture of himself, like, look up, who is this Billie Eilish?
Who is
person?
Billie Eilish?
I thought that was pretty funny, though.
Yeah, one of my friends who is in their late 30s, like me, said, I've never felt older than watching the Billie Eilish thing. I feel two generations away from Billie Eilish, which I got a kick out of. But I do think that was important. I think there could have been a little bit more of a focus on this. But on balance, this is kind of a nitpick.
Okay, so where do you come down in the great Julia Dreyfus debate of 2020? Good, bad, cringeworthy.
I thought she was just okay for me. I do get a good kick out of these like nerds, these you know like National Review nerds who like are like, ugh, Billie Eilish's green hair and Julia Louis Dreyfus isn't funny. It's just like okay, you know, all right, comic book guy, okay, like sitting in your basement. I'm sure you would have done a better job up there. So I do kind of eye roll at the criticisms, but you know, she didn't knock it out of the park for me, but I thought she was fine.
Well, it depends whether you're a fan, and I happen to be such a big fan of Veep that I was willing to cut her a lot of slack. But it was interesting, you know, following it on Twitter, the number of people who said, this is terrible, this is the worst thing, and other people saying, no, this is fantastic, more of this. So the cliched question obviously is, does Joe Biden get a bounce out of this?
Before we get to the bounce, I just want to mention one more thing about last night, because there's been a lot of talk about the Braylon. And that was really powerful.
I want to come back to that.
You're going to come back to that later.
I'm going to dwell on that for a while. Don't worry.
Okay. Well, then good. I'll do rank punditry first, and we can end on the
rank punditry first.
I think that maybe he gets a little bounce. Here's the thing. I think that Biden kind of got his convention bounce with the pandemic and George Floyd and like Donald Trump just like stepping on rake after rake after rake during the spring and early summer. And I just don't know how much more room he has to grow. He is kind of dipped just a little bit in the polling averages. So I could kind of see him dipping back up to sort of where he was at his high watermark. But that's kind of about it, I think.
I think you're right. On the other hand, there is that dynamic out there that people go through the process of going, I can't stand Donald Trump, but they haven't been sold yet on Joe Biden, and there were so many doubts. I think he probably succeeded in answering some of those doubts, not completely, but I wouldn't be surprised if he got a couple of points, but I don't think it's going to be the traditional bounce. Okay, so let's go back to those moments, including that remarkable video of the young man who said, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for Joe Biden because he has a terrible stutter. And that was a riveting moment. What do you think of it?
Yeah, I mean, and I think that it was so powerful. And first, and credit to that kid. And in a weird, I had a weird connection with it because in the Jeb campaign in 2016, there was another kid named Braylon, oddly, who had a disability that was a Jeb fan. He was in South Carolina, not New Hampshire, and we went to his dad's barbecue joint. I think the weekend after Donald Trump made fun of the reporter on stage, and it was probably the best. I mean, the Jeb campaign was like a lot of low notes, so it was a rare high note at that point in the campaign. I'm still Instagram friends with the kid, and his dad actually sadly kind of his dad died a couple of months later, and so this kid has really gone through it. But he was such a big Jeb fan, and he was so moved by Jeb's willingness to come hang out with him that I really felt, you know, kind of what that Braylon kid felt like, that this was not just, you know, a thing for show, but it was also a thing for show, and I think that the contrast between his bravery and going out there and taking that risk, and when we're all sitting there watching as he's kind of stuttering through a word or two, it really kind of just brings home just the cruelty and how debased Donald Trump and his supporters are, you know, that to just watch what it actually is like for somebody who's dealing with this. And I thought that was, yeah, so I thought it was so powerful because it kind of combined both of those things.
Well, I think I mentioned this before we started taping. I watched this. I don't know how you watch these things. I'm doing other things, so my attention is maybe all 80% of my attention on this while I'm doing other things. He comes on and starts talking, and it's like I stop. I'm just holding my breath. What is this? What's going to happen? What could go terribly wrong? And you're there and you're watching him and you're with him and you're focused on it. And I thought it was a very, very powerful moment. And, from just the political, from the human point of view, it was powerful. And you know that that it will highlight the worst of the Trumpian responses, because you have the president himself who mocks the disabled. You know that they have been mocking Joe Biden's stutter. They can't help themselves because this is who they are. It's also a reminder of what another one of the things that Joe Biden has overcome here. And it really does put into context his lack of, sometimes he stumbles. Sometimes he does seem to wander. Sometimes he does have verbal problems. And one of the reasons is this. And so I thought it was incredibly powerful. But now here's my contrarian take. And I don't know whether you agree with me or not on this. So I'm watching this. And I thought there were a lot of high marks. I thought was good. I thought Tammy Duckworth was amazing when she's standing there and she just brought the fire to Donald Trump. I don't want to not mention her, because in another universe, that would have been one of the moments where, you have this, this wounded veteran who's calling the president a coward. I mean, that made me almost think, boy, imagine if she was VP. So Tammy Duckworth, high point.
It was just okay for me. Okay. But like you said, I'm kind of, I have a child, so I'm parenting, yeah. I'm half watching. And so at the Tammy Duckworth moment, I was half watching it. I was watching it, but it didn't capture me. So it's possible that if I gave it more focus, I would have a different take.
Here's my contrarian take, though, yeah. On what really got me. So I watched the young man, and then they do these videos where they introduce him, members of the family and stuff, which were extremely well done. I'm sorry, the grandkids, that was good stuff.
Grandkids broke me, Charlie. I have to say, the grandkids did it more than Braylon for me. I just thought it was so, when the girls all got together and said that we were going to have a family meeting, and that we called it, and that Pop, thought it was just going to be to kind of discuss like what he was going to do. And they said, but that's not what the meeting was about. The meeting was for us to tell him that he needs to do it, that he should do it. I just thought that was, especially because it came on the heels of the Bo video, Bo's kids, not all of them, but some of them were Bo's kids. It came on the heel of Braylon. so I'm a little emotionally raw, and I'm just like, damn it. It connected on both his humanity, but also on kind of the urgency of his candidacy, right? These girls, you can tell they lost their dad. They see that we have a despicable president, and they're like, you got to do this. You got to do this. I just thought that was really cool.
I thought so too. But here's the moment when I sat up straight and went, holy shit, okay, was when they were introducing him, his son and his daughter, Hunter Biden, shows up. Hunter Biden is there. And you could just see Twitter exploding. And I'm going, wow.
Combed his hair. He had his flag pin on.
This has been the taunt. Where's Hunter? Where's Hunter? My good friend Ron Johnson, still obsessed. We got to find Hunter Biden. This is their thing. And there's Joe Biden, puts him right up in center. Look, I mean, Hunter Biden's a flawed guy. He's got a track record. There's issues involving him. But, somebody tweeted out, like, why is Biden putting Hunter Biden on television? And the answer is because he's his son. He loves him. He's not going to abandon him. This is a man who puts his family first. The entire theme of this entire convention has been how faith and family are the lodestar for this guy. And at the most important moment of his life, he's not going to throw Hunter Biden under the bus. I got to say, that's the moment that got me, like, holy crap. Here is Joe Biden being a dad. And everybody's going, why? This is a blunder. Why would he do this?
I didn't get that either.
In retrospect, You go, if he had not had Hunter Biden, people would say, yeah, big family man, throws his own son under the bus, biggest night. I was really impressed with that move. And I'm you know, prepared to be critical of Hunter Biden's business dealings, his judgment. I mean, this guy's been a car crash, but he's still his son. And this was his father. That's the moment that broke me.
Yeah. And especially because it's hard not to, I don't know that a normie fan is thinking this in their head, but us political junkies, when they're doing the Beau tribute, it's hard not to let your mind wander a little bit to like, what does Hunter Biden must think about this? You know, yeah. as Beau, as his brother is being, you know, kind of hailed as this sort of saintly figure, an important figure in his dad's life. And you're like, he's hiding down in the basement and, you know, he's not even there. And then like 10 minutes later, he shows up, and handles himself really quite well. And so, no, I agree with you. I mean, obviously he's a guy who's made a lot of mistakes in his life, but showing up, I thought it was a two-way street. It was impressive as a two-way street.
So this may feel like a digression, but somebody made this point. I thought this convention did a good job of telling these stories about Joe Biden and, you know, introducing him. Back in 2012, in contrast, the Romney convention, there are a lot of great stories about Romney. And instead of featuring those stories, we got Clint Eastwood yelling at the empty chair. And you think back on sort of the contrast of doing it well and not doing it well. Somebody was saying that in retrospect, the 2012 campaign was really almost political malpractice. And I remember thinking this at the time, that a lot of these stories about Mitt Romney going and spending time with one of, you know, his dying friends, that this was in the early hours, that this was not featured, and that somehow they had buried all of this. That I don't know, because Romney, you know, didn't want to do that because he had this sense of modesty that I, you know, I don't want to use, you know, my humanity in a political way. But they didn't do what Joe Biden did last night.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I guess I'd say in their defense that the contrast in that election was not over kind of who was a better person and who was a better family man. You know, so I think that in some ways that it was, you know, a good, smart, strategic move for Joe Biden to do it, but it also was a political move, right? I mean, this is every moment that you talk about a positive character trait that Joe Biden has is an implicit contrast with this current president who has none. You know, I think that in that sense, you know, there's this incentive to focus on that more now than there was then. But I also, that said, I also thought about that last night, and there were some good videos that Romney did that, you know, all aired at like 6 o'clock or whatever, that should have been on later. I don't know that was, you know, the reason that he lost to an extremely talented politician, who had, you know, things were turning around, if a little slowly on the economy. But yeah, I think that that's a fair criticism, and it's something I thought about last night too.
So by the way, as an example that you and I both have incredible self-restraint. I mean, if there's any doubt about our ability to restrain ourselves,
people say that about me.
We have gone more than 30 minutes without talking about Steve Bannon.
Oh, can we do the whole next 15 though on Steve Bannon?
Oh, I mean, this is one of those cases where, you know, that if you have a severe case of Schadenfreude that lasts more than 4 hours, seek medical assistance.
You better send me to the emergency room then, Charlie, because my Schadenfreude has not abated for a second since yesterday morning.
It is so extraordinary. I mean, it really does feel like the script writers really figured, okay, we have to have a boffo ending to this. We have to wrap it up. We have to have all the characters from season one, season two, season three, and they all need to be together. You know, the Charlie Kirks and the Lewandowskis, and let's throw in David Clark and and Chris Kobach and Marsha Blackburn. We're going to put them all in this one great climax, and then there's going to be a boat with a Chinese supervillain. And it's about the wall that Donald Trump, the scam of the entire Trump campaign, the wall that Mexico was going to pay for. I mean, I'm sorry, Tim. It's almost too good.
I'm sorry. No, actually, it isn't going to be Mexico paying for the wall. It's going to be Donald Trump's own supporters. And the money isn't actually going to go to the wall. It's going to go to Steve Bannon's Italian castle. and a yacht that he spends his time on with a Chinese billionaire. Yeah, that's exactly what the forgotten man had been clamoring for. It is just right on the nose, so perfect, and it couldn't happen to a better person than Steve Bannon. Man, I just want to kind of bathe in this story. I want every single anecdote.
We are going to be accused of wallowing in this story. You know why?
Oh, because I'm going to wallow.
We are going to wallow in this story.
I'm going to wallow. And oh yeah, I'll be mentioning it again in the newsletter today. I was thinking about it yesterday and I was like, I don't feel like I covered this with the extensiveness that it deserves. I think we're going to need 2 or 3 entries on it.
It's the pattern. It's not hard to do this. It's almost so much that you're tempted to almost go past the number of people in the Trump orbit who have already been arrested, convicted, charged. He's going to be very busy with all of the pardons. And then you have, think about 2020. And I think Amanda Carpenter did a good job with this. You know, what we found out about, you know, the scams of the NRA, the fall of Jerry Falwell Jr., just how, you know, extensive this miasma of corruption and grift is on the Trumpian Republican Party. And it's got to take a toll, right?
I mean, it's grift all the way down. It was funny. One of the Bannon partners in this grift, it's not really just a grift anymore, in this illegal criminal enterprise. I went to his Twitter feed and his most recent tweet was talking about, mask conspiracies. I mean, it's everything. It's endemic of every element of what the kind of Trumpian movement is a grift, is a scam, the whole thing. And the thing about Bannon that just is why it's so juicy and so delicious is just that his whole shtick has been that he is the guy, the populist, reformer who understands what these elite Republican country club types don't get. And that's that these masters of the universe, these bankers, these billionaires are using us, and they don't appreciate regular Joes like Steve Bannon's dad, who lost his shirt in the financial crisis. And Steve Bannon was really moved by this, by his dad's financial struggles, then how he was screwed over by the elites. And so now he's going to bring this populist strain to Republican politics. And what happens? This guy gets the world. He gets the world in his hand. He has made the chief strategist to the president of the United States, who has no other advisors around him. He could have done anything. And what did he do? He spent his time in the White House like leaking to Vanity Fair and making friends with all Donald Trump's billionaire pals. He gets fired because he has so much hubris. He's making fun of Donald Trump to a reporter for Vanity Fair or some ridiculous New York outfit that no regular people read. And then he goes to move to a castle in Italy and he buys a bunch of yachts with regular Joe's money. Like he wasn't mad that rich people stole his dad, helped his dad see financials hardship. He was just mad that he wasn't the one stealing people's money. I mean, it is just the whole thing was a fraud from the start. And man, do I just enjoy bathing in that, because it was so obvious to so many of us.
Well, it should be obvious. So whether or not, fast forward to next week, we'll be told that what's on the ballot is the defense of Christian values, the little guy, right? Draining the swamp. Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? You know, you look at these guys and you go, yeah, Christian values. Yes, absolutely. Little guy. You know, this is why grandma from Northern Michigan, wrote out a check for $15 to Steve Bannon. And it's also, where do you think the money came from? I mean, the money for this grift did not come from, as you point out, it did not come from Sheldon Adelson. You know, it came from grandma from Indiana. It came from these people who are pounded on a regular basis by the various grifts on the right. And, and quite frankly, look, it's not just Steve Bannon. There is this entire universe out there, and you're totally familiar with this outrage machine which just exists to get clicks and contributions. And the whole thing is keep scaring grandma, keep pounding on them, keep, you know, convincing them that they should send a portion of their Social Security checks to, you know, risingpatriotteaparty.com, to protect America from Sharia law or something like that. And the reality is that you do have a lot of grandmas who are writing portions of their Social Security check to these fraudsters.
Yeah, and the whole populist strain is such a fraud, you know, Charlie. And this is why we had Trump, is because there's this phony argument, you know, I'm sorry, maybe I'm indicting you here, because that I'm sure was made on your talk radio show, that was made on many talk radio shows, about how, you know, what have we conserved? Like, what have the Republic, what is these supposed conservative Republican parties conserved over the last 30 years? Yeah. You know, this was basically the argument against the Republican establishment. What have they done? Mm-hmm. And it's like, What if these populisted, you know, what have they nationalized? What have they conserved? Nothing. All they do is send mean tweets at TV show hosts. Like, that's all the president has done, and get a corporate tax cut. I mean, their whole plan, the center of the populist, overthrow of the party was this wall. Was, we were going to build this wall, and we were going to make Mexico pay for it. And they haven't done anything. They've built like 3 miles of fence and stolen their own supporters' money.
But then again, when you take a serial liar, the guy that founded Trump University and Trump Steaks and Trump's, and you go, hey, let's make him president of the United States. What do you think's going to happen? Okay, before I forget, the one clunky moment on the convention last night, I thought was Michael.
Oh, wait, Bloomberg. We have to stop talking about Steve Bannon. I haven't even made a shirts joke. I haven't made fun of like the pus coming out of his face and how his face is the same color as the orange jumpsuit that he's going to be in soon.
Did we get the mugshot yet?
We haven't got the mugshot. I'm desperately waiting for the mugshot. I'm confused why somebody that Steve Bannon got arrested at sea with a Chinese billionaire. We haven't really had a chance to talk about that yet. Ahoy. He was at sea with, I thought that this was the tough on China crowd. Maybe he was stealing the Chinese billionaire's shirts because he needed a few more layers on his shirts, and that's why he was at sea. It's unclear to me exactly what's happening there.
Did you see Iowa Hawk Blog's tweet?
I did not, please.
God is my witness, I thought that hobnobbing on the yacht of an exiled Chinese supervillain would make America great again. I'm sorry. So I haven't been able to pay enough attention to this. So is Trump World the usual suspects? Are they defending Steve Bannon?
See, this is the thing. He's alienated some people in Trump World. So, you know, the griftiest part of the Trump orbit, you know, the Kurt Schillings of the world, they like Steve Bannon. But the kind of inner circle, you know, he alienated Jared. He's on the outs. Probably no pardon, I think, coming for Steve.
But he's dangerous. See, this is the balance. They hate him, and they don't know him, but he's dangerous because he knows stuff. I mean, he knows a lot of stuff.
He does. So,
I don't know.
Okay, sorry. I just needed to talk about his face and his shirts a little bit more because... You know, you did think, I thought I could get my final, like the chief Schadenfreude joy I would ever get over Steve Bannon was when he was fired from the racist blog Breitbart for being mean to Daddy Trump. That was a pretty glorious moment, but he has successfully gone much lower than that and brought my mood much higher. So I just needed a little 2-minute bonus segment on that.
I mean, it's going to be interesting to see how Breitbart covers all of that. No, you tweeted out that, and we're on the same page with this, that just in case there's any question about it, if Vanity Fair wants to do a 20,000-word story about the arrest on the yacht, I mean, like, we're there for it. And we will read every word of it. Really.
Yeah, I want Caro on this. I want, like, a six-volume Caro LBJ book that I would devour.
This actually could happen. Okay, so I just wanted to take a shot at Michael Bloomberg.
Ugh, thank you.
That was the one clunky moment where I actually, when they had that little conversation among the, you know, former candidates, I thought I'm supposed to hate this, but it was actually pretty funny. And then it's like Michael Bloomberg, you know, gets his own cameo. And it was like that old, you know, spot the rich guy here. I just hope that they got him to promise to, you know, write a check for $1 billion for giving him that solo shot, because what the hell otherwise was he doing there?
I guess supposedly he's going to announce today that he's giving some money, or this weekend, or early next week. And but it's like, better show me the money, man. Yeah, exactly. I get either pay up or get out. I could not agree with you more. He was horrible. I thought his whole campaign was off key on the start. He's the opposite of Joe Biden. Joe Biden, a lot of people did not recognize that Joe Biden really was and is the person for this moment in the Democratic Party. People assumed that because the party had moved left and the party had gotten more into identity politics, maybe there was, you know, some intersectional person who was the person for this moment. But actually it is Joe Biden, because his whole life story is a human response to the current president. And you know, by putting Harris on the ticket, I really do feel like the Democrats did as good as they could have done. And Mike Bloomberg is like the human antithesis of that. Like, he has many of the same flaws as Donald Trump. He is kind of has demonstrated a complete lack of empathy in his life. He is kind of a big government, you know, all this sort of soda ban stuff that he did in New York is really off key from what the moment calls for. I mean, Mike Bloomberg just offered nothing in the primary except that he had money and ran ads and was somebody besides Bernie. Like, that's really the only thing that he had going for him. And now with Bernie in the boat with Biden, he felt, you know, he stuck out like a sore thumb last night. And it's like, you know,
he did.
Put up
he
or
did.
Shut up, Mike. Like, in the fact that he sort of obviously, I think this has been reported, but I think it's obvious in its face that he like extorted the DNC to get a speaking slot in order to give money for a super PAC just shows how gross he is from the start. Just give us the money or just get out of the way.
So I don't want to just move past the fact that we are still only 2 days away from the president at the White House essentially embracing QAnon conspiracy theory. I still don't think people have fully absorbed the significance of this, maybe because, you know, it's been a long time coming. Yes, the president likes anybody that likes him. You know, he's like the alt right. He's into conspiracy theories. But I mean, damn, QAnon. You know, with their, you know, satanic cults of pedophiles and cannibals and deep state and the fact that it's been designated a terrorist organization. And here's the president of the United States saying, they like me, so I'm okay with them. This also feels like the script writers have decided, okay, we can't be subtle. We just have to like push this right absolutely to the edge. And as far as I can tell, Tim, there's what, four Republicans who've pushed back on this? So you got Adam Kinzinger, Ben Sasse, Jeb Bush, Liz Cheney. Anybody else?
Yeah, I mean, I love, God love him, Jeb, but he's not, you know, he's retired now. He's at his golf course hanging out, you know, he's down at the Biltmore hanging out with Kalumba, enjoying his life, firing off a tweet. So I'm happy he did fire off that tweet, but I don't know that we can really count him in the four, seeing as that means there are only three active politicians who have done so. Yeah, I mean, here's the thing,
okay,
Charlie.
Explain that, though. Okay, I mean, I know this sounds like the question that we've had like a million times, but really, this is an easy one, right? You stand up and you go, no, these guys are nut jobs, right? This isn't that hard.
Yeah, what this shows, Charlie, is something that I've said on this podcast many times. People think that the senators are cowards for the wrong reason. Like, everybody thinks that they're afraid of the tweets, and they are kind of afraid of the tweets. They're afraid of the base. They don't know their own base. They had no idea that Donald Trump would win. They were just as confused as all of us that Donald Trump would win. And now they are captors to the most insane parts of the Republican base. And until somebody stands up to them and is successful, it's not going to change. And so, yeah, I'm with you. I mean, there's no loss in saying, hey, guys, like, let's deal in reality here, you know, and let's not be encouraging something that's not just a conspiracy theory that's just wrong, because, you know, that it's wrong to encourage just on the principle of the matter that we shouldn't be encouraging conspiracies. But this conspiracy has really damaged people's lives in real ways. I mean, there have been kidnapped children, you know, it's driven people to insanity, like, you know, going on hunts with guns to try to find, you know, pedophiles in their communities. This conspiracy theory is causing real hurt and real pain in people's lives.
It's insane. It's toxically insane. But they clearly, at least Trump has made the calculation that he's not going to break with QAnon or with the alt-right, because they are part of, they will help him for re-election, and they have become part of the constituency that they need to, you know, of the Republican constituency. And yeah, this, you know, we have a base problem in this country. We have a voter problem, because there are a lot of these people out there, and that's the scary thing. It's not just a handful of people. You know, there are millions of people that follow this QAnon stuff, and Donald Trump right now is the wind, you know, the wind beneath their wings.
And I've said this both on Twitter and in the newsletter, so I apologize to my stans out there who have to hear this a third time. But for people who are just podcast listeners, credit Joe Biden again. The inverse of this happened in the Democratic Party, not nearly as insane, but you know, there was an anti-Semitic Linda Sarsour who was attached with the Women's March. She showed up at, like, you know, at one of these stupid panels that happened at 11:30 that nobody watches at the convention. But, you know, a couple of conservatives saw, you know, caught it. You know, they put out on Twitter that you know, this shows that Joe Biden is an apologist for the anti-Semitic far left, anti-Israel far left. And within like 3 hours, the campaign put out a statement that's like, this woman does not stand for us. This woman is wrong. And Joe Biden does not support it. And neither does our platform. And so in one little anecdote, he just showed that this is not a both sides problem. There is only one side that is at this point in thrall to the extremists. And that's our guys, sadly.
Well, you know,
our former guys.
You make a great point, because that really was his sister soldier moment. And it hasn't got enough attention. It has not been highlighted enough. That's something that
they just handled it. You know, that's why it hasn't got attention. They just did what a normal, you know, politician is supposed to do.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Tim Miller, we could go on for another 50 minutes talking about Steve Bannon. By the way, I haven't even given you my schadenfreude. David Clark was a member, you know, Sheriff David Clark was also on that. It's like there's some
huge magnet.
It's a fascinating phenomenon.
I've got a bonus one as well while we're talking about it. Bannon's podcast partner is Raheem Kassem, who's been a longtime troll of mine. He likes to troll me for some reason. I think it's because he volunteered for the John Huntsman campaign, which I was on in 2012. And so I think maybe he has this underlying deep-seated shame about the fact that he used to be kind of a rhino centrist like me, and now he's gone in league with the gross Steve Bannon. But he has this podcast with Steve Bannon, which I'm just... I don't know. Maybe he'll find a new racist criminal to fill Steve Bannon's chair in that podcast. I don't know.
There's always another one. There's always another one. Tim Miller, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast.
Thanks, Charlie.
We will do this again really soon. And thank you all for listening to this weekend's Bulwark podcast. This is the podcast that will be up all weekend, and we will be back on Monday and do this all over again. As of right now, there's 73 days to go until the election.